Today is May 12th, 2009. My name is Varanya Chaubey and I'm sitting with Mr. Remington Eastman, who's project manager of the Media Monitoring Unit at GCOM in Guyana. Thank you, Mr. Eastman, for participating in this interview.
Thank you, Ms. Chaubey, and thank you for having me.
We'd like to begin by asking a little bit about your personal background. So would you describe the position that you hold now and how you came to it?
Okay. Just to reintroduce myself, my name is Remington Eastman. And presently, I'm the project head for the Media Monitoring Unit of the Ghana Elections Commission. Just a brief insight into my background, which is not very spectacular. I hold a diploma in public communication from the University of Guyana, and I also hold a degree in mass communication from University of Guyana. I started work with the Media Monitoring Unit in 2006 at the level of supervisor, and I was appointed a manager in 2007 after the incumbent manager departed, which would be Mr. Jainarayan, after he departed to do his postgraduate in communication in England.
I'd like to now ask you, go back to the issue of setting up the 2006 Media Monitoring Unit. Would you describe your role during that time?
Okay. I was not integrally involved in the setting up of the unit. I was one of the fortunate ones who was interviewed and employed in the unit at the level of supervisor. But reflecting back on that period, on that time, the person who I think was the most important person in the setting up of the unit, and that will be in 2006, is a guy by the name of Mr. Tim Neal. He came to Guyana in 2006 as the consultant to the Media Monitoring Unit, and he played a very critical and important role in the formation of the unit, and most importantly in the methodology that the unit started to use then and is still using now.
Now, what was Mr. Neal's affiliation?
Mr. Neal came to Ghana as the consultant, but his portfolio, he worked with the British Broadcasting Corporation for I think something like 30 years, training radio announcers. That was his job with the BBC. He has a wealth of experience in media in general, because he has worked in Africa, he has worked in the Caribbean, he has worked in various parts of the world. So he brought with him a lot of experience, a lot of knowledge of media and what professional journalism is all about. So he was able to impart a lot of knowledge to us who are employed to monitor the media, and he was also able to impart the experience to practicing journalists in the country.
Now, you mentioned that he, among others, were important in coming up with the methodology that was used. Would you describe that methodology and what the outside the experiences he brought from his career outside Guyana?
Okay. The methodology that Mr. Tim Neal introduced, and I wouldn't want to take away some of the praise from Jainarayan, because he was part of that process also in coming up with the methodology. But as Jainarayan stated earlier in his interview, it is basically a methodology that is based on quantity and quality. We call it we call it quantitative and qualitative. Quantitative, we look at in terms of the broadcast media. We time them in terms of minutes. How many minutes of positive coverage they give to a particular political party during the 2006 elections. qualitatively, we look at if any infringements of the media code was manifested by any one of these TV stations or newspapers or the radio station. So basically, the methodology, in summary, was quantitative and qualitative.
Now, I'd also like to ask you, in 2007, you mentioned you were appointed manager.
Yeah.
What were some of the challenges you faced going into your job?
Okay. When I think I should backtrack somewhat and say that I left after the 2006 elections. It was basically for two reasons. I left the unit because it wasn't certain whether the unit would have continued, because really and truly the life of the unit should have come to an end after the elections. The elections ended in August 2006, and the life of the unit should have come to an end 1 month after, which would have been in September 2006. Between September 2006 and, say, January 2007, we were uncertain whether the donor community would have continued funding to the unit. As a matter of fact, after the September cutoff date, no funding came from the donor community. The unit was kept alive through the Ghana Elections Commission. But again, the donors thought that the unit did a very good job in 2006 in ensuring that the elections, you know, was peaceful and so on. And they thought in their collective wisdom that the unit should continue. But there was that period of uncertainty between 2006 and 2007 when we didn't know exactly where we stood. So, you know, they say that the first law in life is self-preservation. So I opted for another job offer that came my way. I worked for a while with the U.S. Centers for Disease Control. I worked in community mobilization and public relations. After the incumbent head got a scholarship to do his master's in England, I was invited by the head of GCOM, Dr. Suraj Bali, to come back and head the unit. And that is how I returned. When I returned, some of the challenges that I faced, some were logistical, in the sense that we weren't getting the resources that we require to really keep us functioning the way we're supposed to function. And secondly, the other challenge that I had was really asserting the presence of the media monitoring unit again within the media environment of the country.
And how did you go about doing that?
Okay, let me take it one at a time. In terms of resources, normally, whenever donors are going to disburse money to whatever project it is, you have to come up with a plan. You have to come up with a project proposal that is attractive. You have to come up with your objectives. You have to come out with what you intend to achieve. And once it's attractive, once it makes sense, the donor community is always willing to chip in and aid in the process. So it was really sitting down and coming up with a plan of keeping the unit alive. Keeping the unit alive in the sense of coming up with outputs, coming up with goals, coming up with objectives that was in sync with the thinking of the donor community at the set time. What we came up with, they found it attractive. It was saleable, you know, and we were given, from then to now, we have been given the resources that we needed in terms of not just keeping the unit alive and kicking and going, but in terms of transforming the operations of the unit. Because during the 2006 elections, the unit was using analog technology to get his work done. We all know that analog technology right now is obsolete. So there has been a transformation from analog technology to us being fully digital. Good. That was one challenge. The other challenge was getting the media to know that the media monitoring unit has not been dissolved. The media monitoring unit is still in place, because at the end of the elections, the media went back to its same old habits. Same old habits in the sense that there were a lot of instances in both the print and the broadcast media of inaccuracies, of unsubstantiated allegations, of inflammatory rhetoric, of the peddling of racial remarks and so on. So even though the media was brought under some sort of self-regulation during the elections time, with the media monitoring unit, or the perception being that the media monitoring unit is no longer wrong, the media went back to its old habits. So the challenge for the unit, not so much for me, I don't want to take the praise, right, for the unit, because we work here as a team. The challenge for the unit was to get the media to come back in line. That, I think, was a major challenge then and still is a major challenge now. Why it's a challenge? Reason being that for you to get the compliance, for you to get the cooperation of the media, there must be something that you can hold them to. The 2006 election, the 2006 media code of conduct that was drafted for the election is basically an election document. It basically like look at some of the issues that will come up during an election, and made pronouncements on how journalists should go about addressing these issues and so on, in order to have equity and fairness and accuracy and so on. But outside of an election, this document was kind of limited. So there was nothing to really hold them to. There was nothing to hold them to, really. So what the unit did is that we referred the practicing journalists in the country to what Jiang Ryan referred to in his interview as the best practices associated with journalism. And we look at documents such as the Media Code of Ethics from the Society of Professional Journalists. We also refer to documents like the Media Code of Ethics used by media organizations, respected media organizations such as the British Broadcasting Corporation, Associated Press, and so on. And we wrote to them and we let them know, well, hey, look, this is what you as a professional journalist should be abiding by, because this is what obtains globally, okay? And based on that, we have been able so far to solicit some amount of, I shouldn't say some amount, but an acceptable amount of compliance and cooperation from the local media fraternity.
Now, it appears that during this process, you have had to be in contact with the media houses themselves. What have been the challenges of doing that, and how have you gone about convincing people, whether it's on a personal level or through formal discussions?
Okay, one of the major challenges that I have found so far, and here's where I want to mention that the media monitoring unit is not the only media monitoring unit that I have in the country. There is another media monitoring unit called the Advisory Committee on Broadcasting. Now, the Advisory Committee on Broadcasting is a legislated body, meaning that it came out through legislation from Parliament. The media monitoring unit, on the other hand, is not a legislated body. It is really like an informal body in the form of a project. Now, the Advisory Committee on Broadcasting has more clout than the Media Monitoring Unit. The reason being that the Advisory Committee on Broadcasting can take legal action against airing media outfits in the country. The Media Monitoring Unit cannot do it. The other difference between the Advisory Committee of Broadcasting and the Media Monitoring Unit is that the Advisory Committee on Broadcasting really relates to the broadcast media only. It does not relate to the print media. So in that sense, the Advisory Committee on Broadcasting is very limited. They're not only limited in scope, they're also limited in terms of their technical capacity, right? They're still using analog technology and so on. They are also limited in the sense of credibility because they are seen as a government body, as against the MMU, which is not government affiliated. The MMU is funded by international donor support. So in the sense that we are not seen as being like aligned to like the government or any political party or as such. Now, the challenge is that the Media Monitoring Unit work is based on suasion, on moral suasion, in that we cannot compel people to follow along a certain path, right? We can only advise them, right? So that is one of the major challenges that we have, in that we can have discussions with people and so on, but then they can still go back and do the same old thing as often happens. The ACB, when the advice is more in terms of, it's not merely such an advice, but it's more like a warning, right? That precedes legal action being taken. But as I said, the ACB is restricted, and a lot of things that we are able to uncover in the media, they are not, right? So that has been one of the major challenges for the MMU, in the sense that we don't have that legal authority, that legislative authority to sanction. The most we can try to do is to convince people through our mere presence, through our credibility, and through our integrity.
That seems like quite a challenging task.
It is.
Are there some tactics that you think have worked particularly well, and some things that you would like perhaps your counterparts in other countries to know about?
Well, I wouldn't speak in the present. I would go back to the 2006 election. I think the most effective tool, I won't say one of the most, but I think the most effective tool in getting compliance of the media is, as you put it, name and shame. That is the most effective tool in getting compliance with media, because even now that we're outside of an election period, whenever we come across transgressions in the media, and we write to them and give them the evidence of the transgression that they would have committed, we always get that that query from them, that we hope that the other media outlets don't know about this. So I've based on my experience working with the unit, I think the most effective tool, outside of legislation, I mean, legislation is the most effective tool, yes, but outside of legislation, the most effective tool is to name and shame.
Now, you mentioned the ACB can actually take legal action. Would you be able to provide some examples off the top of your head in cases where they have done so?
Yes, they have done so very recently. But it don't be a case of the ACB actually themselves taking legal action against these media outlets in the broadcast media. It's a process whereby they advise the Prime Minister, in this case now is the President, who has authority over the broadcast media in the country, because one of his posts or one of his positions is Minister of Communications. So that's why they call the Advisory Committee on Broadcasting. They advise the President, and then he in turn institutes legal action. Oh, and coming to the to some examples, there was an example of Channel 6 that was closed down for 4 months because of an infringement of their broadcast license. There was also the instance of Channel 9 being taken to court. Basically, those are the two examples that I think stand out.
Now, you mentioned this name and shame tactic is particularly effective when you yes. have moral suasion in order to get compliance. Mm. Is there also the case that as you work in this position, you build up relationships with people in media houses, and then that you're able to use that to some degree to persuade media personalities?
Definitely. From writing these media organizations over and over, eventually we get to meet each other on a one-on-one basis. And they get to understand what it is that we're trying to do here at the media monitoring unit, and that is to raise professional standards of journalism in the country. We have gotten the support of many of them, but many of them are still recalcitrant, still recidivist, but it's a work in progress.
Now, what are the reasons that those who are reluctant to come on board provide for why they choose not to comply?
I guess it all hinges on the fact that they know that we can only try to influence them to go along a different path. There is no way that we can compel them. I guess that would be the main reason why some people have not fully come on board as yet. You know, I mean, we might see an infringement committed by a particular media outlet. We may write them. But then again, you see it happening again probably like a couple months down the line. And then we remind them that, look, we point this out to you before, but that is the case on time. But in most instances, I must say that we have the cooperation of most of the media in the country.
Now, I'd like to get a sense for the sorts of meetings that you have with people at the media houses. What is the sort of level of leadership with which you liaise?
If you could rephrase that question to me, when you say the level of leadership, the people that I interact with? Or
yes, the people that you interact
with. Okay, well, I mostly interact with editors of programs. I interact with editors. If a program, let's say on TV, doesn't have an editor, then I interact directly with the program host.
And how often do you find yourself meeting them? Is there a formal mechanism for meeting?
No, there is no formal mechanism. It all depends on either they requesting a meeting with me or I requesting a meeting with them. There is no structured approach to the whole thing in the sense that we have meetings every month or every quarter, no. It just happens on an ad hoc basis and also happens on a need to interact basis.
I'd like to move now to the question of technology. You mentioned that this media monitoring unit has moved from analog technology to digital. What were the sorts of cost considerations associated with that? How did you make that move in the most cost-effective way?
I must say that in moving from analog to technology, it entailed a significant cost. But the good thing about it is that it is a one-time investment for years to come. It entails a significant cost. I will not be able to give you the figure off the top of my head. In terms of U.S. dollars, but in terms of Guyana dollars, it was something in the vicinity of like 10 million, something like about 10, which was perhaps maybe like about 50 to 60,000 U.S. dollars to make that transition.
And what was the technology that you brought on, the digital technology?
Well, the digital technology, as the term implies, is computerized technology in the sense that we have moved away from using VCRs and televisions to capturing everything, doing all our work on the computer itself, meaning that we are using computers to capture TV programs.
And where did the idea for this technology come from?
Oh, this idea actually came from a British consultant that we have working here at the Guyana Elections Commission, a guy by the name of Gavin Campbell. And if I may add, this system that we're using now, this computerized system that we're using now, has been used as a model in Malawi. As a matter of fact, it's now being used as a model in Malawi because the same guy that I referred to earlier, Mr. Tim Neal, he recently set up a media monitoring unit in Malawi. And I was in a position to furnish him with all the technical details and in terms of the equipment and everything that he would have needed to start the unit on the same basis that we have it here.
Now, if you hadn't chosen this computerized route, what were the other options that you were considering at the time in order to move to digital technology?
There was no other option, really. I just put the idea to Campbell and asked him to come with something because we needed to move away from this analog technology. It was becoming very problematical in terms of storage, among other things. And we have limited space. And he just came up with that based on his, he's very knowledgeable in terms of computer technology and so on. So, you know, it was no big thing for him, really.
I'd like to ask a little bit about preparations or your activities since the 2006 elections and what you see as the role of the Media Monitoring Unit going into the next set of elections.
Okay, from the end of the 2006 elections to now, the Media Monitoring Unit has been kept very busy in terms of trying to keep the media in the country, you know, behaving in a professional way. I think the importance of the Media Monitoring Unit to the whole fabric of the Guyanese society was played out or was manifested during, I don't know if you would be aware that we had something in this country called the Lusignan and Mbatika massacres. You may not be, but it was all over the global media and so on. We had two massacres in this country, which was the perception is that it was racially influenced because it was seen as an attack by Africans against East Indians, in which, you know, a lot of people lost their lives, including small children, children just months old. You know, that's why it was referred to as not just the Lusignan killing or the Bartik killing, but as a massacre, because it is a case where defenseless people were killed while they were sleeping. It's not a case where there was an armed confrontation, right? In the aftermath of that, in the midst of it and in the aftermath of that, we had a sort of behavior coming out from the media, certain sections of the media, just as in elections time, where you had certain sections of the media, you had East Indian extremists were given airtime. In the newspapers, they were given a lot of space, column inches. That's in one section of the media. In another section of the media, you had African extremists who were given space, and in the newspapers, they were given a lot of column inches, especially in the letters to the editor column. And there was this spewing of racial propaganda and race baiting and so on, and it was exacerbating the then situation. There was at that time during the massacres at Lusignan and Bartik, this country was almost on the brink of a racial war between the two major camps. And this racial war was being fueled, not implicitly, but explicitly, through the media. And here's where the Media Monitoring Unit really stepped in and really calm nerves, really stepped in and got media personalities to really tone down the rhetoric. And this was not just through writing to them. This was a more proactive approach in that the leadership of the MMU went from TV station to TV station, newspaper to newspaper, showing them what the consequences of filtering this kind of information through the media can have. You know, by referring to his, to historical precedents like Rwanda, Yugoslavia, and so on. Here is where the value of the Major Monitoring Unit to this country was proven. Because even though we are, as I say, a kind of quasi-body, as against the ACB, that is a legal body, the work that we did then in bringing some sort of calm, some sort of acceptable peace among the warring factions is well documented.
That seems like it was quite a significant move by the
It was.
By the MMU. But when you mentioned that the leadership of the MMU took a more proactive role, who was that that was involved?
Well, General Ryan was in England at that time. So we didn't have a functioning deputy. So it was basically me, right? But I don't want to take... I don't want to take any praise. I don't want to take, so I prefer to, because I had to depend on the work of what the monitors are doing, right? They bring the evidence to me. I am not manager. I cannot do everything at the same time. I depend on them as much as they depend on me. So it was a team effort. That's why I said the management of the MMU, right? Thing. So yeah, basically it was the team of the MMU. Okay, but in terms of interfacing with the media personalities, with the editors, with the talk show hosts and so on, that was basically my job. But in terms of me taking the evidence, it had to come from somewhere. And that's why I said it's a team effort.
I'd also like to ask about the MMU's relationship with GCOM. What are the sorts of issues on which you interact? Is it a formal institutionalized meeting process? How does that relationship function?
Okay, the relationship with MMU and GCOM. Now, when donors give funding, they would give it to an autonomous body if it's in the form of an NGO. Outside of that, if they're going to give funding to any organization, that organization has to have what you call a formal structure. The MMU, in order to get funding, had to come under some organization, whether it's a media organization, which doesn't really exist in this country. It had to come under something. And basically because the MMU was formed to really monitor the media during elections, the appropriate organization that the donor side fit to form the MMU was the Ghana Elections Commission. Now, the relationship between the MMU and the Ghana Elections Commission is more a formal one, in the sense that the head for the MMU is Dr. Suresh Bali, who is the chairman of the Ghana Elections Commission. How does the work of the MMU impact on the work of GCOM? Now, GCOM has a public relations department. That public relations department depends on us to furnish them with certain information that is in the media. Whether it's somebody protesting against the electoral system, whether it's somebody who feels disenfranchised, whether it is somebody who is making unsubstantiated accusations against the organization, which is continuous, which is perennial. The Public Relations Department of the Ghana Elections Commission doesn't have the facilities to really keep tabs of all of these media organizations. We have that capacity. So we have what you call a symbiotic relationship. We depend on the Ghana Elections Commission in terms of securing funding and keeping the organization going. They depend on us in terms of their public image, getting the evidence to rebut and so on.
Now, are there certain issues on which the leadership at GCOM becomes involved with in dealing with the media houses?
If just go back that question again for me.
Are there certain issues on which GCOM becomes involved in dealing with the media houses? Either they sort of interface with the media houses or...
Yeah, they do. They do. They interface with the media houses a lot. As a matter of fact, Ghana Elections Commission holds a lot of press conferences. A lot of these press conferences would be to bring the media up to work on the... Bring the media up to speed on the work of the commission, especially in this period when there is there will be local government elections sometime before the end of the year. So yes, they interact and they interface with the media, you know, on a continuous basis.
Well, we've covered a lot of topics here, and I'd like to ask you now if there's something I haven't brought up that you would like to discuss.
Well, between this interview and the last interview that you would have done, I would have guessed that you would have covered a lot. I guess you would have covered more than what you actually set out to discover. It could be that we could have missed certain things along the line, depending on what your objective was. But I think there are just two things I would want to touch on. Just two things I would want to touch on before we actually, you know, do our wrapping up. One thing is very important. We got to understand that Guyana is a third world country, a third world developing country. And I use that word developing very carefully because developing is supposed to be an incremental process. You're here today and you're there tomorrow. But this development or this process of development can only occur in an environment that is conducive to progress, that is conducive to development. Now, politicians, civil society, the major stakeholders in society could mout how much they want about democratic governance and accountability, whatever. Going to elections and voting for a government is not the end of the process. Now, the link between democracy and an anarchy, that link, believe it or not, is the media. The media has shown, and I mean there are so many studies that have proven it, that the media has that ability that it can either nurture a democracy or it can derail it. Worse yet, an unrestricted media or a media that doesn't have no legislative controls as obtains in a country like Guyana. If it is not controlled, if it is not brought under some sort of administrative control, it can be very deleterious to the development of the country. This was proven in 2001 in this country. And in 2006, it was proven with the setting up of the media monitoring unit that once you have a conducive media, you won't only have free and fair elections or elections free from fear, but post-elections, you can also have a peaceful society that is conducive to the development process. After saying that, is really making a case for not the MMU, but for a professional media. And this is the work of the media monitoring unit in this country, to nurture and to foster a professional cadre of journalists.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much, Mr. Eastman. You've shared a lot of information with us. Thank you so much.
Yes, and let me thank you for being so patient with me.